Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the official podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My name's Craig Barker. In this podcast, we explore the relationship between people and objects. Today, my guest is Tony Hurley, teacher, educator and historian. And I'm especially thrilled to have Tony join us because this is a podcast that explores the connectivity between items in the Chow Chak Wing Museum and people. And Tony has a particularly unique connection with some of the photographs that we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Tony. Thank you so much for joining us on Object Matters.
Oh, thank you, Craig. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Now, could you begin by telling us a little bit about your career as a teacher, as an educator, as an author, as a historian?
Okay, as briefly as possible.
As briefly as possible.
Well, because history is the main focus today, I should go back to my high school years and say I got hooked on history in my senior years. And I remember studying Thucydides for history honours in the last year of the old Leaving Certificate, which is a bit of an indication about my age, but I'll leave it to you to guess. I did my undergrad degree here at Sydney Uni back in the late 60s. What a heady time that was. I studied English and history and languages. And I do remember Richard Walsh and Richard Neville were the editors of Honisoir, which was a tearaway magazine back in those days. Yes. It was Vietnam wartime, moratorium marches, and moon landing.
Yes.
I remember skipping a lecture, a French lecture, in 1969 on that day in July to go to Manic and sit and watch the moon landing on a tiny little television screen way over in the corner of the of the room. So they're happy memories of Sydney. I did my dip ed also at Sydney Uni next door here on a teacher scholarship, and my first year of teaching I was sent out west to the mountains to Coonabarabran in the Warrumbungle Ranges. I had a year of interesting teaching there.
Yes.
Between 72 and 75, I left teaching for a short time and went on a working holiday overseas, which is kind of what one did in those days. Unfortunately, because it was 72 to 75, I missed the three most important years in Australian political history, the Whitlam years. And that's a tragedy of the first order. I've tried to make up for it since, I might add. When I returned from overseas, I spent the next 25-odd years teaching in state Catholic AIS schools. And I think my longest stint was as head teacher of history at Catherine Macaulay, a wonderful girls' school at Westmead. Teacher education, towards the end of my my high school thing, I gravitated into teacher education, initially at UTS and then at Sydney Uni again in the teacher education, history teacher education here. Wonderful students, Sydney Uni, I have to say. Even though I'm plugging the institution I'm at, I have wonderful times there with those students, and I do kind of miss it a bit. So it was a wonderful way to complete my educational life, if you like.
Yes, coming back.
I was teaching English and French in my early teaching career, and then I got the history bug big time, and especially Egyptian history, which I became interested in. It was introduced into the senior curriculum only in the 80s. I remember I went to a particular, I started at a new school, and I said to the students, what would you like to do for your HSC? Here's a syllabus. And they said, oh, Egypt. I said, oh, I'm sorry, I've heard of Tutankhamun, and I know there were pyramids, and that is the extent of my Egyptian knowledge.
Yes.
So I was on a very steep learning curve, and Egypt has become one of my priorities in recent years.
Yes.
So that was an interesting little opportunity, I suppose, and I've taken about seven or eight student teacher tours to Egypt when one could do those things. In terms of authorship, mid-90s, I was invited to co-author some senior ancient history textbooks, and I thought that would be a good start. So
these are the the Antiquity series.
The Antiquity series for 11 and 12, and I began with the wonderful Philippa Medcalf, sadly no longer with us, and Jan Rolfe, and we produced a couple of editions. So we produced four altogether. And the last two editions with my co-author, Christine Murray, and myself. And the fourth edition is just out in 2018. So they were good years, busy years, but very good ones. I should also mention here the History Teachers Association, which I've been a member of for a very long time. For the past 15 years, I was editor of the journal, and that's a wonderful thing. And you've made some wonderful contributions yourself to our journal.
Yes.
And looking forward to some more, too, Craig, where they come from. And of course, I was president of the association between 2015 and 2018. So four very busy years, and also interesting years in terms of curriculum development and learning about the teaching profession across the state and the wonderful people who contributed to our journal. The teachers who really are so,
passionate about
teaching and sharing their expertise. So teaching history is just a wonderful vehicle for supporting history education in New South Wales.
Yeah. Well, I guess, look, on that note, because, you know, you have worked with thousands of school students and so many different teachers, how, you know, in some of that experience, both in the coalface and also in terms of curricular development, providing textbooks and so on, how important do you see museums in history education in Australia, in New South Wales?
Well, for me personally, they're absolutely central to my teaching practice. And they're absolutely critical storehouses and purveyors, if you like, of history. They offer students and their teachers too, I might add, opportunities to engage much more directly and immediately with history through the artefacts and the selection of material presentation, not so dry as in other presentations. In this throwaway age, when everything has to be brand new, museums are sanctuaries for safeguarding the past. And sanctuaries, I use that word very deliberately. Mm. And a school visit to a museum, especially the new Chow Chak Wing, looks absolutely spectacular. I've seen a little bit of it already. A school visit is worth about two dozen lessons in any classroom. So I'm hooked on museums as well as history.
Great. What about your own personal experiences with the collections that are now in the Chow Chak Wing Museum, the old Nicholson and the old Maclay?
Oh, look, I have a softer spot for the Nicholson and the antiquities, especially the antiquities collection there. I've had the pleasure of bringing many students to the Nicholson for those wonderful hands-on history sessions with your educators, and they've always been very popular with my students. We especially love the mummies in the crypt at Nicholson, and I hope they're available again.
Wait till you see them in the Chow Chak Wing Museum.
Looking forward to it. And I should add here, the History Teachers Association has been very fortunate to hold their annual prize-giving ceremony for the HSC High Achievers at each year in the old Nicholson Museum. Mm. And I always get a goosebump when I pass the bust of Augustus, whom I would regard as the chief master of ceremonies for any historical occasion in the museum. So I hope I'll get the chance to meet him again.
He's still around. Oh, he's still loitering around.
Excellent.
Now, I guess moving from the antiquities to what we are talking about today, what items from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection are we discussing today? Because we've got two of them. And what is your personal unique connection to these objects?
Well, we're looking at two rather... These are from World War One, and they are of Bristol fighter planes. They were the kind of earliest kind of fighter planes that we have for war in the air, if you like. And they are over Palestine. And one is flying in, and as you can see, the one is coming into the hangars. And they are pictures of the...
photographs, we should stress.
Photographs of the 1st AIF Air Squadron stationed in the Middle East, who flew over Turkish lines. And in fact, under Allenby, dropped some significant bombs, which secured the British and Australian victory, Bathsheba and others.
And this is all part of the quest to take Jerusalem too, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And to stop the Suez, stop the advance of the Turks to the Suez Canal. So this is all part of that. And the war in the air is much less known. Mm. We know all about the mud and the trenches, but the war in the air should be better known. But my grandfather, Captain Frank Hurley, who was the official photographer for the AIF in the war, took these pictures, so that's my personal connection to them. He was there between late 17 and early 18, just after Bathsheba, in fact.
Yes, right.
And he obviously was interested in the potential for air photography.
Yes. Look, we're going to come back and talk about your grandfather more and about Frank Hurley's career more generally, but also his time in the war. Let's talk a little bit more about both the images, which of course are also for our listeners available from the museum's collection search. But as you say, they're both images of Bristol biplanes. One of the shots is titled, let me get this correctly, one of the shots is actually titled Machines Returning to the Hangars, which is this sort of lovely silhouette, isn't it?
It's beautiful. It's a typical Hurley shot, actually, especially the clouds. My grandfather is noted for his love of clouds. He had about 50,000 pictures just of clouds in his collection, which he would use to superimpose or otherwise manipulate an image to get the desired effect, especially in the Middle East, which he fell in love with when he was there.
Right.
He absolutely loved everything to do with the Middle East. So that's really quite a stunning shot, isn't it?
So with that shot, he's on the ground watching both planes that are positioned on the grounds and out the front of the aircraft hangar, the temporary hangar.
That's right.
As a number are flying towards us. The other shot, we've got quite extraordinary image taken from an aeroplane. It's looking down.
He actually flew with Captain Ross Smith, who was... Right. I would say the Red Baron, the equivalent in Australian terms of the Red Baron, highly distinguished. He was only 22 in Palestine at this time when he was flying. And Hurley, they became fast friends, actually. Hurley went up with him on a mission. The first one was to find out how to secure his camera. Look, I have a lovely little moment from his diary here where he says he wants to find out how he can actually include film, not just photographic images, but film images. He wants to film.
Oh, right. Okay.
The war in the air. He said, I intend producing a film that will include all the incidents connected with the bombing raid.
Mm-hmm.
He liked a bit of danger, apparently.
Yes, right.
And his first flight in February of 2018, I made experiments to ascertain the points of minimum vibration. Imagine the vibration.
Yes.
And have decided to clamp the machine across the gun cockpit, if you wouldn't mind, insulating it with flat rubber sponges under compression. The gun cockpit. I hope they didn't have to use
that. No, I was going to say, I hope you consulted with the actual...
this is the technical side of it. But when he was up there, he absolutely fell in love with the whole business of aerial photography and seeing the landscape from the plane. He had actually flown also on the Western Front
during his time there. Well,
yes, so he went up in a few observation. He wasn't actually in any action, but in some observation aircraft over the Western Front. But he was very keen, of course, to go again in Palestine, where it was probably a little less dangerous. But even so, the second mission with Smith wasn't actually they went behind enemy lines.
Oh, okay.
They went behind enemy lines, and he says, this is typical of his purple prose, by the way.
He got very purple.
He said, oh, the exhilaration of that upward climb. Up, up, up we go. One is too absorbed in contemplating the mighty works of nature to heed the vile endeavours of the Turkish rabble to shoot us down. Our great bird even seemed to enjoy it and moved along, purring and cleaving the Jordan atmosphere with felicity and joy. Isn't that delightful?
That's amazing.
I think he had an eye for history as he wrote his journal.
Yes, no doubt.
You know, one would question some of the intention behind that, but as a statement of his sheer joy at this.
Also, I mean, it's such an early stage in aviation, full stop.
Absolutely.
You know, the actual novelty of being in the air.
Well, look, those Bristol fighters look like toy planes to me, compared to the Lancaster bombers, for example, of World War II. Hugely dangerous.
Yes.
We don't appreciate enough, I think, the...
Forget about aerial combat,
the
sheer danger of just getting off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Keith Smith was really, or Ross Smith, he had his brother Keith, was an absolute ace in the air. Distinguished flying crosses, military medals, the whole bit, before the end of the war, and he was only in his early 20s.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Young and foolhardy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, let's take it back a little bit and let's talk a little bit more about your grandfather. Who was Frank Hurley?
Well, he was my paternal grandfather. My father, also Frank, was the youngest of his four children and the only boy, and were all born between 1919 and 1923.
A very short period.
Yes, four children in as many years, yes. Right. But he was away on photographic missions most of the time, otherwise there might have been many more children.
Yes, right. Probably lucky for his wife that he had two
Of his entire career, he wouldn't have spent more than a third of his married life at home in Australia. So I think Antoinette, his wife, I'm also Antoinette, named for her, developed a life of her own pretty much.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It must have been tough raising four children.
You're going to ask me now to talk about his career, aren't you?
I am, yes. Because, I mean, he is a figure that is well known in general Australian history and then obviously within Australian photographic history. But could you give us sort of a potted history of what he achieved?
Can I first recommend the best book on my grandfather that I think has been written by Alasdair MacGregor, published in 2004, and I think it's been republished as a paperback. And it's just called Frank Hurley, A Photographer's Life. For anyone who wants to read more about grandfather and every aspect of his career, this is no hagiography. This is a warts and all.
Yes.
And he admired the man tremendously, but he was also aware of his, what we call in history, our values and limitations. Anyway, he began his photographic career in his teens with a box Brownie camera, I think, which is in the National Museum.
Oh, is it?
Yes, you can have a look at it there. He belonged to a photographic club at Ashfield and was taking pictures for postcards, very popular in those early years before the war. And he used to do amazing things, like jumping on a train track, waiting for a train coming at him to take a picture. full on before jumping clear and getting the perfect shot, of course. He liked those moments of danger, I have to say.
So a sense of adventure.
Yeah, absolutely, and nothing, you know, boys own stuff. Think of Rudyard Kipling. He was living that kind of life, anyway. He developed a reputation early on, and next thing we know, he's on Mawson's expedition to Antarctica in 1911, less well-known perhaps than the next one, which was Shackleton's 214 to 216 expedition. And he went as the chief photographer of those. And I think the Shackleton expedition made his name in a very certain way, after the event, of course. But anyway, when his Shackleton and his team, and I won't go into the details because the whole Antarctic episode is an exciting story. Mm. It's wonderful to read. But after 2 years having been stranded there and having lost the ship and surviving, all 22 men came home. I think that is one of the most amazing things in Antarctic history.
It is a remarkable story of endurance.
Absolutely, yeah. It's not so much the ship, but the men themselves, yes. Yeah. When they were finally rescued and returned home, it was World War One, and many of the 22 men who had survived went off to the war to fight, and of course, quite a few of them died as well. Hurley was appointed as official photographer to the AIF and found himself on the Western Front at the Third Battle of Ypres, at Passchendaele, as we call it, in the end of 217. He was working there under the direction of Charlie Bean, and that's another entire chapter, which is an interesting one. This is a very controversial chapter. Charlie Bean didn't like the composite pictures that he was making.
I was going to return about this, but of course there has been so much discussion over the decades
It's a very well-known story, but anyway, a grandfather's diary records quite explicitly what he thought about Charlie Bean's opposition to his composites. After the war, he came back home. He spent some years taking, you know, the lantern slide productions all around the country and talking up and, of course, making his fortune and his career. And he was hugely popular at doing that. Right? A showman and an entrepreneur as well as a photographer.
Yes,
but he was a commercial photographer.
Yes.
That was his major interest, not so much, you know, recording history, I think, which is an important thing to remember, I think. During the 20s, he went to the Papua New Guinea and was photographing the tribes people there and their customs. Another interesting controversial period of his photographic career.
And I should just mention in passing that, again, within the Maclay collection of historic photographs, that we do have overlaps with his work in Antarctica, his work on the Western Front, and obviously also his work with Papua New Guinea. A lot of this, of course, is associated with lantern slides that were used for teaching at the University of Sydney, which I'll return to in a moment, because the two that we're specifically talking about today fit within that category as well, too. But it's kind of interesting that we have shadows of the various phases of his career,
Here in the museum. Yeah. That's wonderful. Well, World War II broke out again, and he was once again appointed official photographer. And he went back to the Middle East, where he spent 4 or 5 years. By that time, though, he's quite a bit older. Mm. And he was competing with some of those young guns. Ron Maslin Williams, great name in Australian photography. Damien Parra, of course. Yes. And George Silk, whose name is legendary as well. And they had different ideas. I think grandfather was really interested in clouds and landscapes.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to be producing these cinematic films for propaganda purposes on the war front. And I don't think he was quite so interested in that as in the landscape and the beauty of the Middle East. The war was kind of a secondary thing, although that's probably emphasising that point a bit too much. But anyway, he did, to cut a long story short, he ruffled quite a few feathers. And that's an interesting chapter in the book, which I don't know personally about. Most of my information is from Alastair, thank you very much. And once home again in the post-war years, he kept up photography. He produced some absolutely magnificent books of Australian cities of the time. His collection of wildflower make coffee table treasures they are, and a magnificent book on the Holy Land, which he could never quite let go of. He was totally fixated by the Middle East, to, you know, that Orientalism in a sense.
Yes, very much,
for a young man.
Romantic idea.
Yes, absolutely romantic. Mm. And more about that later. He was still photographing with my dad. Used to go with him up into the mountains, and he'd spend a whole day lying in wait for the right light and movement of clouds before he could take a shot. So he was a total perfectionist. Estelle Laser, who is a wonderful
one of the ancient historians and archaeologists here at the University of Sydney.
Well, she did some work on Mawson's Hut, the restoration of Mawson's Hut down in the Antarctic a few years ago. And she went into the dark room where Hurley produced all his film, and she found inscribed in the desk. Do you know this story?
No, I don't.
Inscribed in the desk, "Near enough is not bloody good enough."
Wow.
Which says quite a bit of, I think the bloody might have come later, but anyway, that was him. He was an absolute perfectionist.
Yes.
And it has come down through the family in some interesting ways, but anyway. And of course, he died then in 61. He had a heart attack, but he was photographing almost up to the very end.
Mm. What was he like as a person?
Ooh.
I mean, obviously you were a child at the time.
I was 13, actually, when he died in 61, in January. We used to visit as a family. He's had a beautiful home at Collaroy on the Plateau, and he was a gardener par excellence. He loved to garden, had a beautiful garden. He wasn't a grandfatherly type, or even a fatherly type. His career was photography,
yeah.
And I don't think he could split himself too much, so I don't have any fond memories of sitting on his lap and hearing stories, as you might do.
Mm.
I do remember one day he took us down the stairs and showed us the door to his dark room under the house where he developed all his photographs, and he said, "That is not to be touched. You don't go there." He used to disappear when we came to lunch and come back and just have dinner, but he was always busy doing whatever. I think he came from a generation that said children should be seen, if necessary, in brackets,
yeah.
and not heard.
Yes, well, I guess if he didn't spend much time with his own children and the idea of spending time with grandchildren.
I know Tony and Adelie, my aunts who are now gone, who were the keepers of the Hurley flame for many years, often spoke about the fact that he was married to his camera.
Yeah.
And that's as it was. You can't be everything to everyone, can you?
No. To go back to the Great Wall, and of course, I mean, yeah, in specifically the images that we are focusing on today for this recording, but, you know, I had seen so many of the Western Front images, and again, we have a number of them within the collection of slide lanterns, but, you know, they are so iconic. But I must admit, I was completely unaware, personally, of his time in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
We've already talked a bit about the year, or the tiny bit over a year, that he was there as well. Do you know any more about... I mean, it's obviously set up a lifelong love of the Levantine area of the Middle East, but...
If you read his diaries from the moment he arrived, I mean, he's coming from the mud of Flanders, right, into this exotic desert location, and the war is pretty much over. It's kind of mopping up operations.
Yes.
Beersheba has been fought at the end of October. He didn't arrive until late November, December, I think. So, and because he missed Beersheba, he still had to have the masses. So they organised some wonderful moments of the cavalry lining up, pretending to charge. There are some wonderful recreations of what might have happened after the event. And the soldiers were only too happy to get into their uniforms and parade and pretend they were whatever. So there are quite a few of those, what we call studied, prepared shots rather than the real thing.
Yes.
He went back in World War II, of course, and covered things like Bardia and Tobruk, about which, you know, not a great deal is known about that. But he absolutely fell in love with the landscape, the people, the smells, etc. And, of course, that's when he met my grandmother. Do you know that story?
No, I did not know that story.
He was on leave, having arrived and done some initial, you know, flying, etc. And there are 2 months of blank in the diary, which is when he was in Cairo meeting and marrying my grandmother. He went with some friends, a dashing young Australian, you know, his slouch hat, the uniform, the whole bit.
Yeah.
I'm sure the local girls were overwhelmed, some of them anyway. Well, my grandmother was. She was a singer in the opera, at the Cairo Opera. And he went along with some mates first night. It's a bit like one of those Ziegfeld Follies movies, you know.
Yes.
I think about it like that. And he saw her, and as the French would say, the coup de foudre, lightning bolt, and that was it. He went every night, we're told, for 14 nights with chocolates and flowers. And at the end of 14 nights, he proposed to her. And she said, oui, or yes. I don't know that he didn't speak any French.
Gosh,
and I'm not quite sure what language we thought she was French, but ancestry tells us that she was actually from somewhere very different. Some family history is proving interesting at the moment. But anyway, so they went for a honeymoon. They were married in April of 1918, and they honeymooned on a felucca on the Nile.
Wow.
Which was something I did on felucca, but I didn't actually honeymoon there. And then back to Australia. And, of course, within a short time, she had the twins, I think, Tony.
Gosh, what a culture Tony shock for her.
1919, can you imagine coming with probably without much English, I would think.
Yeah,
she did speak some French and Urdu because she was educated in the foothills of the Himalayas, can you believe? Catholic nuns were French. So there's an interesting story to be found about my grandmother. Yes, and my must have been a culture shock of a major order. I don't think she had a lot of support.
And then to be stuck at home with four young children.
Well, she lived very comfortably, of course, on grandfather's earnings, but and the children became her life very much, the four children, yes. But yes, I love that story of my grandmother. I just wish I had got it from her, because she didn't speak much about her early years at all.
When did she pass away?
In the 80s, late 80s. Right, she lived on 20 more years after grandfather. And she was a very colourful character. She wore huge, great flowing caftans, rings on every finger. Very exotic, over-the-top character. And she smoked. I've never forgotten this. She smoked with a long cigarette holder.
Yeah.
With these kind of unfiltered cigarettes in the end. And never, ever, because I began to smoke back in those days. I played around with it for a bit. And I said, Gran, I said, show me how you smoke. And she said, I never inhale. And I said, what? How come? Oh, I don't. But you'd follow around the house with ashtrays, because you're dropping ashes everywhere. She was the most colourful, exuberant character, and she maintained that.
Yes, once you've been on stage, you're always on stage, haven't you?
Yes, she had a beautiful voice, I have to say, a beautiful voice, singing voice. Yes.
And again, it's a really lovely insight, and part of the reason why I'm so excited that you're able to join us today, that behind the objects, quote-unquote, that we are talking about in this series of podcasts is that personal story of people.
He loved, in fact, interestingly enough, last year at the National Museum, the library, there was an exhibition called Pilgrimage, Hurley in the Middle East, and that's a perfect title, because when he went back in World War II to cover the war, he fell in love again with all of that. And some of the pictures from that time are beautiful in terms of the use of light and shade and colour and landscape, rather than the war doesn't figure too much at all. I'm sure he produced documentaries, etc., but he was absolutely besotted with everything to do with the Middle East and the diaries, The diaries are the most purple they can be when he gets to his Middle Eastern period. Right.
You're listening to Object Matters, the official podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My special guest this episode is Tony Hurley. Tony, it's interesting, we talked a little bit about the composite images before, and you also talked about reenactments of the Shahs of Bathsheba and so on. That question, and you also made that very perceptive comment that he wasn't necessarily see himself as a documentarian, even though he was there to document the war. But as a historian, and as someone who's, of course, written about and done so much work in terms of ideas of propaganda, when you look at a historic photograph such as these, how does your brain as a historian and as a teacher of history engage with them? Are these to be seen as accurate representations of what were happening, or particularly given your grandfather's
predilection?
Yes.
Predilection he was a commercial photographer and an artist with his camera. And something I found in the biography by Alastair was very telling. And he wrote this in 1910. He would have been all of 25, and he was part of his camera club, and he was already experimenting with a whole heap of different photographic techniques. And he said, "Regard your camera as an artist does his brush. Think that you hold a piece of apparatus worthy of the same possibilities as the artist, if you will strive to exercise your discretion and ability by judicious imagination and manipulation." And those two words sum up very much what he was about. I mean, and in the days since we've had photoshopping, he would have been in love with Photoshop.
Yes, yeah.
Things he would have done. Not to mention, remember airbrushing?
Yes. Yeah.
I was told at school, and that's quite a long time ago, that photographs, of course, never lie. They are so much more accurate than written sources.
Yeah.
And, of course, that is absolutely not true.
Well, we've all seen images of Trotsky being airbrushed out of photos from the...
Do you remember when Alexander Dubček of Prague Spring was airbrushed out of his own country and his own images by his Soviet masters? So, I mean, I think we've got to question photographs just as hard as we question any other source. Mm. And because they are mute, in a sense, they need probably a lot more investigation than even the written word.
Mm.
So the idea of manipulation and images, I mean, I love this little quote from him about the manipulating images, the famous Zonnebecker image, which I think everyone knows, the over-the-top, which is 13 different negatives
altogether
to produce the one. And this is what he said when Bean said to him, "We're not having any of those composites, Hurley." And Hurley wrote, "I have tried and tried to include events on a single negative, but the results were hopeless." Remember the artist in him. Everything was on such a vast scale. Figures were scattered. The atmosphere was dense with haze and smoke. Wait for this. Shells would not burst where required. And yet all the elements of a picture were there. Could they but be brought together and condensed? On developing my plate, there was disappointment. All I found was a record of a few figures advancing from the trenches and a background of haze. Nothing could have been more unlike a battle. It might have been a rehearsal in a paddock.
Wow, I mean, that's extraordinary.
That speaks volumes about what he thought he was doing. Mind you, the Canadians were doing this. It was common practice,
yes,
at the time.
Yeah.
But Charles Bean said, oh no, we must have the actual record. And this is where I come to Hubert Wilkins. And I want to make a plug for Hubert, because I think I would have been proud to have been Hubert's granddaughter. I really would. Mm. He was an amazing man. Even more of an adventurer. A cinematographer. He went to the Arctic. He was into aerial photography. He probably produced the first aerial films in the war.
Yes, right.
Quite apart from grandfather. He should be better known to Australians, and I want to make a plug for him. Dr. Richard Harris, you remember he was 219 Australian of the Year?
Yes.
Who rescued those boys in the
Thai
caves. Well, he is a Hubert Wilkins enthusiast, and he's established the Wilkins Foundation.
Mm.
Hubert Wilkins was photographing the war with my grandfather on the Western Front with Charlie Bean, and Charlie Bean had much more time for Hubert Wilkins.
Yes.
And his work.
Yes.
And in fact, some of grandfather's photographs are possibly maybe even Wilkins. We don't know.
There's some
debate,
yes,
about a couple of the images, and I think that's rather interesting. But Richard Harris came to the national conference, this teachers conference in Adelaide last year, and gave a wonderful delivery on Hubert Wilkins. So I really recommend him to you.
Mm.
And he would be a wonderful subject of a podcast should you have a Hubert Wilkins object in your collection.
We will go and have a look.
And look, the book about him, which I recommend to everyone, The Last Explorer, Hubert Wilkins, Australia's Unknown Hero.
Mm.
And he really deserves a mention. Published in 2007 by a Simon Nash. Just Hubert Wilkins and you'll find the book. But I recommend it to you along with grandfather's biography. He really deserves to be better known. Amazing career, even beyond grandfather's in terms of the number of things he was into and his expertise and his whole lot of areas.
You mentioned earlier about your grandfather's remarkable self-promotion as well.
Absolutely,
so that's,
yes,
part of it. And indeed, part of that is the very reason that we're looking at these two images from the Maclay collection, because they came into the museum via the Department of Geology, along with a whole lot of other images from World War One and from Antarctica,
right,
where they were being used as teaching lantern slides.
Okay.
And so, of course, we're looking at representations of those images, which have been scanned from the original teaching lantern slide. As an educator, there's sort of a lovely meta story in here of us looking at images that have been reproduced to be used as teaching tools as well, but obviously they were also being commercially produced as well.
That's
Can you
right.
talk a little bit about your grandfather's commercial relationship in terms of
how
he was making money out of the images he was creating?
Oh, well, he did. I mean, I have to say, he he crossed swords with Mawson about the early into 1911. He regarded pictures as his own personal property, and Mawson said, no, they're part of the expedition's kind of resources. I think he might have had the same argument with Shackleton. And there's a wonderful story about when the Endurance was going down, and Shackleton said, okay, boys, go and get out what you need from the ship. She's going down.
Mm.
And they got all the glass plates, because that's what they had in those days, and Shackleton said, there are too many here, we cannot possibly keep these. And my grandfather said, if you want the world to know what's happened here, we need to take these home.
Mm.
This is according to the diaries,
yes,
and of course one would question them, but anyway, yep, Shackleton's diary might be interesting on this point.
Yep.
But they smashed thousands of slides, or possibly hundreds,
mm,
and the collection they brought back, of course, did make his fortune,
yes,
and
yes,
made the expedition's fortune in a sense. But he and Shackleton had fallings out over lots of things to do with the financial and other arrangements, etc. But he was very much a showman. He went, he took his lantern slides and his sentence. You know, we've talked about photographs, but
yes,
he produced a lot of films, of course, in those days. The Home of the Blizzard, which was from the Mawson expedition, was very famous in its time, and he spoke to packed houses all around the country, and this was all pretty new, of course, in those days. He produced, interestingly, the first colour photographs from World War One, from Palestine.
Yes.
First colour photographs, so he was an innovator in that sense. But yeah, he spent most of his life commercially producing pictures. I mean, apart from the absolute love of the photographic operation, there was a career to be made, and he was very much on the lookout for any opportunity. Someone suggested New Guinea to him, he thought, yes,
yeah,
I'm off.
Yeah.
And any other, and And he went back to Antarctica several times, not with Shackleton, I might add, but on different expeditions. He was in love with all of the wildlife and the scenery of Antarctica, as anyone who's been there would be.
Yeah.
So he was very much, would say, an entrepreneur and a commercial artist, and not a historian, much as I would have liked to say that he produced some of the most historical photographs. But he did capture, I think, in his own way,
moments in time,
those incredible moments that might well not have been captured, silhouettes of men crossing duckboards and, you know.
Well, certainly very evocative, as indeed the two images we're looking at right now from Palestine, but so evocative, aren't they?
They are very much so. And you know what? Those boys who flew in those Bristol fighters, they really are heroes. And hats off to all of them, because we don't hear... This is something else that these pictures remind me of. We know about Gallipoli.
I mean,
as a teacher, Gallipoli is almost exhausted its potential,
yes.
I think.
Yes. And of course, so much of the mythology is developed as opposed to actual history.
Yes, well, that's a whole other podcast, I can tell you. But we don't know so much about this theatre of war. And, I mean, the Palestinian campaign and the attempt to take the Suez were hugely strategically important, and we don't hear much about them. The same in World War II. We don't hear so much about African campaigns. And Tobruk should be lionised along with, you know, Kokoda as it was, because of what happened there. I'd like to see a much broader curriculum in terms of studying the war than just Gallipoli, which could be, you know, part of the whole story, but not the only one.
I agree with you. I've got ancestors who were in the Australian Light Horse in Palestine as well too. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, once upon a time it was a well-told Australian story. You think of the movie, the 400 Horsemen.
400 Horsemen.
And so on. So it's certainly was part of the Australian war narrative, but it's dropped off.
And Chevelle, who was the leader, and what a wonderful leader he was of those Light Horse Brigades, and Bathsheba and the battles, the capture of Gaza and then Jerusalem afterwards. They're amazing stories, and they have not been given, I think, the justice they deserve in terms of our knowledge of the Great War and World War II, for that matter, as well.
How do you find yourself responding to these photos when you look at them?
Oh, look, the fact that Hurley went up in that plane... in conditions, and was happy to go over the trench, Turkish trenches, which they did. He was really into enjoying moments of near death as much as possible. Mm. There's a wonderful moment on the Western Front as well when he talks about jumping out of a crater made by a bomb just before another one went off.
Right.
With he and Wilkins survived an enormous blast, but they were there in the front line taking pictures. And this is what he did. He wanted to go up, not just in observation, but to actually fly over. So I think about him being prepared to take any possible risk. I'm amazed that I'm here, actually, sometimes. I watch some of his Antarctic stuff and I think, oh, I'm very lucky to be here. He managed to get back and have a son who was my dad. So, yeah, I think just sheer, what's the word, just sheer absorption in this particular job, and the opportunity to live a life beyond the confines of an Australian life, because he spent most of his career travelling the world and doing his photographs. So it was a great life as a photographer, I must say, and I don't think he would have regretted too many of any of those moments.
Yes, well, and a remarkable time in human history, though. Mm. The question I'm asking everyone who guests on this particular podcast is to choose one word. In one word, what would these two photographs look like? Yeah, signify to you?
I've thought about this a bit. I think I would choose the word focus. I know it's a photographic term, and of course that's what he was on about, but in both its literal and its figurative sense, absolutely tunnel vision photographic career, which made him the great photographer that he was. And he had the luxury of being able to devote himself,
yes,
a body and soul and heart to that enterprise. And I think also the fact that his I don't understand all the technical aspects of what he was doing, and in the box brownie days and with those huge things.
Yeah.
But the process of developing and taking his photographs, and the time that he took, the focus on getting the absolute shot that he wanted.
Yes.
And in terms of choosing any amount of negatives to get exactly the effect that he wanted, I think focus is probably the only word that accurately... I mean, there are many others, but I think that was one word I would certainly choose for this occasion.
Particularly the conditions that they're working under.
Absolutely.
To not just to take the photograph, but to also develop. How important are photographs for a historian? Coming back to your career, your work.
Yeah, well, they're another source. And I mean, in teaching, they are indispensable because they are visual and immediate and students can straight away hook onto them, provided you ask all the right questions. So for me, I mean, I've often used my grandfather's photographs in my own teaching with all the advisories around them. And I think it's a wonderful way to approach this interrogation of sources, because while they are valuable and immediate and visual, they're also, as I said before, needing kind of questioning to make sure that we don't take too much at face value. Yeah, for sure.
I guess to wrap it all up, and whilst these particular images that we're talking about today are not on display, not on public display in the Chow Chak Wing Museum currently, but I have no doubt that we will have some Hurley images used in future exhibitions, and certainly we have an extensive historic photography collection.
Great.
And currently an exhibition called The Photographer's Studio.
Oh, good.
How would you like people who come to the museum who see, and well, not just these two images, and indeed perhaps not even any images from your grandfather, but historic photographs, what would you like them to actually think about when they engage with an
image? I would like them to think about this part of the war and how much more we need to understand about it and the sacrifice that was made by those guys who went up. I mean, it was an adventure for them too, let's face it. But at the same time, we know relatively little about this part of the war. And I think those little Bristol fighters are amazing machines. I mean, you wouldn't have caught me dead, even looking at one on the ground, let alone going up in them. But then I'm not my grandfather's granddaughter. I don't even want to go to the Antarctic. It's too darn cold for me. But no, I would like us to be more aware of that theatre of war and how important it was, and the contribution that all those men, the light horse, we know a little. I mean, every time I drive up the mountains past that light horse interchange, I think of that, and that's a wonderful tribute to the light horse. But I think we could do a lot more. And I think people would say, "Ooh, what kind of plane is that? How was it used?" I mean, and they were dropping bombs. Yes. They were dropping bombs out of these little Bristols over Turkish trenches, and that made a big contribution to the end of the war in the Middle East in World War One, certainly. So I would like them to be curious and want to know more and go and Google Bristol fighters and Ross Smith and find out more about the people who really made a difference in that, apart from my grandfather's own contribution in photographic terms. Isn't that wonderful? That silhouette of a plane against the cloudy skies.
It's such a... You know, it's war. It's a horrible experience, and yet
but
it's such
pure,
a beautiful image.
It's pure Hurley. It's pure Hurley. He loved that effect much more even than that one. I mean, that's the one on the left, which shows a plane coming into land at the hangars, is a shot. But this one speaks to me in greater volumes than the other one, perhaps. Yes.
Look, Tony, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. Thank you for sharing your personal and family stories as well. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. It's been a pleasure. Memory Lane.
Object Matters is recorded on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum pay our respects to the traditional owners, and we acknowledge elders past, present and emerging. Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website sydney.edu.au/museum.